This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Lo and Behold on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. So the 322.5 billion ringgit budget, the largest budget ever tabled in Malaysia, was passed yesterday. So it's called a budget for the people by the Prime Minister, and it was arguably also the most intensely debated proposed budget in recent times. So today on the show, we want to give you a 101 on the budget, how it's tabled, the approval and legislative process, and discuss hypothetically possible scenarios that could have played out had the budget been rejected. So joining me now to do that today are Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, a Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Malaya, and Niu Sin Yu, a Constitutional Lawyer. Welcome, gentlemen. How are you today?
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. So, you know, a lot of intense debate. You know, Budget 2021 was, well, it's been reported that it's been passed at a policy level at least. And now I understand it will be debated at the committee stage, and that's going to take place from next week onwards. Maybe, you know, for those people who are unfamiliar with those two stages, you could explain what that means, you know, policy level, committee stage. What does all of that mean?
Okay, let me first of all point out that in any elected parliament, the control of national finance is one of the most important functions. And in the Malaysian constitution, under Article 96, 98, 103 to 104, the raising of money and the spending of money must be authorized by parliament. There are a few exceptions to that. We'll cover those later on. But generally, parliament has the role of authorizing the raising of taxes and the spending of money. Now, the budget 2021, as you mentioned, was yesterday met with approval by a majority. There was no one-by-one vote, basically a voice vote. Many newspapers are saying that it has been passed. That's a little bit optimistic and premature. The budget has passed the vital second reading stage. I acknowledge that the second reading is a make or break stage because that's where the policy or the principle of the budget is debated. No amendments are allowed at the second stage. It's the principle of the policy. There must be a debate and there must be a vote. And Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin can be optimistic that because he has crossed that hurdle, there's a good chance that he would cross the other hurdles. But please do bear in mind, there is now a committee stage that is coming, I think, December 4th. Then there'll be a report stage where the committee reports to Parliament. Then there is a final third reading. At the committee stage, they are not discussing policy or principle. They are looking into the nitty-gritty details, the detail, what they call items or votes, as they call it, specific items. They propose amendments at the report stage and the third reading. Again, policy and principle are involved. So there is a lot that can happen between now and December 17th when we are told that the final vote will take place. So it's not true. The budget has not yet passed, but it has overcome the second vital stage indeed.
Okay. Sinu, anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I agree entirely with Prof. And the passing of the supply bill, it's like any other law, really. So we are currently at the second reading. There's still a third reading to come. And, you know, if that supply bill could not be passed at the third reading, then you have a loss of supply. Effectively, you have a situation where the Prime Minister has a loss of supply. So it's a bit inaccurate, like Prof said, to say that the budget has been passed. The budget has not been passed. They have merely agreed as a matter of policy to proceed with the debate of the budget. And then, like Prof said, you know, you have the committee stage, and that's where most amendments will come in. And I think it'll be quite interesting to see what happens at the committee stage, because I suspect there will be amendments being proposed by MPs with regards to this supply bill. So let's see what happens there.
Okay, so basically what's happened was the Dewan Rakyat just passed the second reading of Budget 2021, and there's still a lot more in that whole process, right, ultimately?
Yes. Yeah, the important thing to mention is that at the second reading, no amendments are allowed. It's basically a debate on the principle or the policy. Now the real debate comes on, where actually the minister's white paper will be examined item by item. Now, I don't want to be exaggerating here. Obviously, time is a problem. Anyone who has been involved in the drafting of the budget, even for his own department, will know that actually the budget will run into thousands of pages, not hundreds, thousands of pages. Every department actually has items, sub-items, sub-sub-sub-items. So there is no way MPs can, at the committee stage, examine all the nooks and crannies of the budget. But nevertheless, MPs will be able to home in on particular issues. And I think the minister will have to defend, or the ministry people will have to defend themselves. The beautiful thing about the budget is that it has a very important committee stage. Now, Sinyu will agree with me, hopefully, on this. Actually, all legislation can go through committee stage. But we don't have that tradition in this country. Normally, legislation doesn't go through committee stage. As far as I know, in the last 63 years, only about 10 times have bills been committed for the committee, special committee stage. Otherwise, normally what happens is after the second reading, the House, the whole House converts itself into the committee. But when it comes to the budget, I have to say this, that there are two aspects that are quite unique. One is this, that there is a pre-parliamentary stage, which is not required by the law. But what the government does is that MOF, Ministry of Finance, does it, that it invites people to participate, to give their feedback, suggestions. And I understand that for this particular budget, 40 or so organizations were consulted. I know some will say 40 is not enough. Yeah, maybe so. But nevertheless, 40 organizations were consulted. They gave their opinion. I have to clarify, consultation doesn't mean compliance.
That's right.
The government doesn't have to comply. Nevertheless, they were consulted, and that's good, because in democracy, there should be discussion before decision. So that's one aspect of the budget that's democratic, and that there is pre-parliamentary consultation. Secondly, as we discussed just now, unlike other laws, the budget always goes through the committee stage, which is very important.
Has there been a situation in the past where a budget could not be passed, either in the Malaysian parliament or in other countries? And, you know, what sort of happened in that situation?
I have to alert you here, Juliet, that what happened in other countries may not necessarily be happening here, relevant here, because we have a written constitution which has some rules. To answer your question, has this ever happened before? I know that in the state of Pahang, a few years ago, a few decades ago, there was this problem where the assembly approved the budget, but I think the Tuanku Sultan was not in agreement.
Okay.
So the chief minister did not resign. Nevertheless, ultimately, he had to go. Ultimately, he had to go, but immediately that did not happen. His resignation did not come about. In Australia, I can think of 1974, I think. What happened was that Prime Minister Whitlam, leader of the Labour Party, got the budget passed through the House of Representatives, but the budget got defeated in the Senate. Now, in Australia, the Senate and the House of Rep are on par. The Senate cannot be bypassed, like in Malaysia. Under Article 68, Senate can be bypassed on the budget after 30 days. But in Australia, that's not possible. So there was no budget, which means the civil servants, the police, the army, and the Governor General himself cannot be paid. So the Governor General called Whitlam and said, "Why don't you advise a dissolution? Call an election, let the people solve this problem. give you a majority in both houses. Whitlam said, no, I don't advise you to call an election. And you know what happened? Governor General Sir John Kerr dismissed Whitlam. He dismissed Whitlam, who had a majority in the House of Representatives and who got the budget passed through the lower house but could not get it passed. So there is this precedent that if the budget fails, that means in Commonwealth countries generally, that means it's a vote of no confidence. However, I have to alert you here, while I'm all for adopting conventions, a convention is not law. Mm. A convention is a constitutional practice or standard or a rule of morality, political morality, that is regarded as binding by those to whom it applies. Regarded. It's not binding. It's regarded as binding. The important thing about conventions are that they are self-executed. Mm-hmm. They are not other-executed. In other words, courts will not enforce them. It is those to whom it applies who must, as a matter of ethics. Mm-hmm. So in Malaysia, the problem is Article 43, Clause 4, says that if the Prime Minister loses the confidence of a majority of the members of the House, majority of the members of the House, not majority of the members present and voting, eh? Mm. There's a difference. Eh, Juliet, there may be 100 members present, in which case 51 is a majority. But Article 43, Clause 4 talks of the majority of the members of the House, which means 112 out of 222 mm-hmm. in the Dewan Rakyat. Mm-hmm. So I think that convention that if the budget fails, the PM must resign, the convention in the UK, to this convention we must graft on the constitutional rule that it must be by a majority of the members of the House. So that's my word of caution. While I'm all in support of conventions, and really, without conventions, the Constitution cannot work. There are hundreds of conventions. For example, question time in Parliament is a convention. Mm-hmm. Committees of Parliament is a convention. No law requires. The standing orders are not law. They are just... So I'm very supportive of convention, but I have to alert you, conventions cannot override the Constitution.
Okay, Sinyu, please, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I agree with Prof Shad. And that's really the problem with conventions, isn't it? If it's such an important convention, you would think that, you know, the drafters of the Constitution would see it fit to spell it out in the Constitution itself. Yeah. So, but I suppose, you know, that's really part of this Westminster tradition of Parliament, where it's drafted in a way where... We don't have to spell it out for you. You know, you need to do what is right. It's drafted in a way where everyone is presumed to act decently and act properly. But as we have seen, you know, over the years, sometimes traditions in one country, conventions in one country, it doesn't really work that well when transplanted onto another. And like what we have here is a situation where if the government is not able to pass the supply bill, the government quite simply is not able to withdraw monies from the consolidated fund for expenditure.
Yes, yes.
Mm. Yeah. And I think it's quite clear whether or not members of parliament are present to vote or not vote for the budget. A government that is not able to spend money is not able to govern.
Exactly.
Because the day-to-day running of a government, you know, it requires expenditures to be withdrawn. And if I can't trust the government with money, I can't trust the government with anything.
Yeah, money is actually at the heart of government, indeed. You're right. It's at the heart of government.
I'm speaking today to Emeritus Professor Dr. Shad Salim Faruqi, who's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya, and Niu Sin Yu, who is a constitutional lawyer. And they're giving us a bit of a 101 on the budget, you know, how it's tabled, the approval and legislative process, and also hypothetically possible scenarios that can play out should the budget be rejected. We're going to continue that discussion after this quick break. You're listening to Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Law and Behold on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line today are Emeritus Professor Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya, and Niu Sin Yu, a constitutional lawyer. And we're discussing Budget 2021, which passed the second reading yesterday in the Dewan Rakyat. And we're kind of finding out what all of this means. And, earlier before the break, gentlemen, we were talking about how, the speculation of Budget 2021 being turned into a no-confidence vote against the PM might have happened, right? There was speculation of that. So let's speak hypothetically here. Say the budget fails, right? So it fails to be passed. What would that have done to the Prime Minister's right to govern? You know, does a defeat on the budget amount to a vote of no confidence?
Actually, if the budget proposal fails, please allow me just to outline four very significant consequences, though I'll come to the consequences for the PM. Number one, of course, is, as Sinew pointed out, there are very significant economic or administrative consequences. The government has no money to spend, to withdraw from the consolidated fund, and that's very serious indeed. However, bear this in mind that the Constitution does provide for a little bit of contingency there. Some items of expenditure like pensions, gratuities, debts, or awards against the government are pre-authorized by the Constitution. However, these amount to only about 20% of the budget. 80% of the expenditure becomes unpayable till authority is obtained from Parliament by the existing, or if the government falls by the new government that is appointed. Second very important factor is the Prime Minister's right to govern falls into question. Thirdly, the young Di Pertuan Agong is drawn into the vortex of our political happenings, political struggle. Mm-hmm. And actually, he would be faced with a number of very difficult dilemmas, moral, in our case, even medical, economic, political dilemmas whereby decision one way or the other may be seen as partisan, though actually he was simply struggling to find the best interest of the nation. So he's drawn into the vortex of the political struggle. Fourthly, and this is a long-term thing, if the budget fails, that means there was crossing the floor.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That means people's faith, citizens' faith in the system, the respect for the MPs weakens more than it is weak right now. Yes, indeed. So I think these are the very serious four consequences of the fall of the defeat of a budget. Now, coming to the specific issue as to what will be the effect on the Prime Minister's right to govern, as Sinew pointed out earlier, the British convention is that if the budget fails, the Prime Minister must resign. This is a long-standing British convention. However, I just wanted to point out to your listeners that actually in England on this issue, some change is taking place. In 2011, England passed the Fixed Term Parliament Act 2011. Mm-hmm. And now in England, the confidence or no confidence vote must be specifically worded to trigger a general election. So if you want the government to fall, you have to have a vote of no confidence specifically saying that Her Majesty's, that this House has no confidence in the government of XYZ.
Right.
Secondly, bear this in mind that even in England, partial defeats on the budget do not result in no confidence. For example, in 1994, the UK government was defeated on VAT for fuel, value-added tax for fuel. So what the Chancellor of Exchequer, the finance minister, did was he just brought new proposals and the government did not resign. So UK also is undergoing some changes, but I'm quite sure that a defeat on the budget will result in a subsequent vote of no confidence in the UK. The Malaysian position is more complicated. Nothing in our constitution explicitly equates a budget defeat with a vote of no confidence. Nothing.
Okay.
However, as we mentioned earlier, Article 43, Clause 4 does talk about the Prime Minister losing the confidence of a majority mm-hmm. of the members of the House.
Yeah.
Now, any budget defeat, as I mentioned earlier, must be, in my view, with an absolute majority of 112 out of 222.
That's right.
Now, what happens if there is this defeat on the budget? Must the PM resign? Juliet, I have to be very frank with you. I don't know the answer to this question because, as we said earlier, British conventions may not fully apply.
That's right.
The Prime Minister may desire to continue. What he may do is he may reintroduce the budget, renegotiate with the opposition, amend it, propose a compromise budget and say, that's what it is. I'm going to reintroduce the budget. Additionally, he may, as an interim measure, introduce a temporary supply bill under Article 102 to introduce a bill to withdraw money from the contingency fund under Article 103. There is this possibility. And, you know, this will be a little bit difficult for the opposition. If the Prime Minister says, I want an interim supply bill to pay civil servants, and if opposition members shoot that down, oh my gosh.
Oh dear.
That's going to be politically very damaging. So the Prime Minister may use Article 102. But suppose he fails to get this Article 102 temporary supply bill or an urgent supply bill. Well, in which case, I think there'll be immense pressures on him to resign. And that's where the Yang Di Pertuanagong will be put in a difficult position. The Yang Di Pertuanagong wants the government to run. Yang Di Pertuanagong wants a budget to be in place. Yang Di Pertuanagong may have to ask the king to come and see him. And he may remind the Prime Minister of Article 43, Clause 4, which says, if you lose confidence, then you have only two choices, either resign or advise dissolution. So I think the king may have to take the initiative. I don't have a clear example, but I know that in Perak in 2009, Dato Sri Dr. Muhammad Nizar Jamaluddin was alleged to have lost confidence. So he was asked by the palace to resign. And when he refused to resign, actually, he was removed from office. So the Yang Di Pertuanagong will be put in this very difficult situation, though nowhere in the Perlembagaan does the law allow the king to dismiss a prime minister. We'll have to say, if there is such a stalemate that the budget cannot be passed and the prime minister's government is at a standstill and yet the prime minister doesn't step down, well, I think the king will have to step into the breach. And the king will have to say, you have to step down so I can form a new government that can now pilot the nation through this crisis.
Just to add, we have a very odd situation, actually, and where you have, on one hand, a lot of MPs saying that, oh, this is a government that no longer commands the confidence of the majority, yet at the same time is able to pass by the second reading, you know.
So baffling many people today.
You could have a situation where this is a government that is not able to eventually pass the budget, but yet the Prime Minister would continue to command confidence of the majority. So it's a very odd situation. I can't think of any example anywhere else, or even in Malaysia, of that. So you have, and if this situation persists, you have a situation of a deadlock where the House is not able to pass the budget, and at the same time, there is a hold off as to whether or not there is confidence in the Prime Minister. And this is why I thought, as a matter of public importance, it was necessary for the motion of no confidence to be debated first in the House so that you ascertain whether or not this is a government that has confidence of the majority. Then only, you know, you move on to the next stage of deciding whether or not that this government is able to pass a budget. But the way it's being done now, this looming question of whether or not this government has confidence of the majority, it's still very much alive. And I don't think that is helpful for the debate. I don't think it's helpful for the public in general. So I think it's a, you know, it's really a problematic situation. Of course, like what Prof Shah said earlier, by convention, he should tender a resignation, but I must say that the defeat of a supply bill, again, like what Prof Chad said, does not explicitly state that the House of Representatives has no confidence in the Prime Minister, as would be otherwise stated in a motion of no confidence.
Yes.
And just to add with on PERA, if in PERA, you can have extraneous evidence to indicate a loss of confidence, then, you know, by extension of that logic, surely evidence from the House when it comes to a defeat of a supply bill would have equal, if not greater force, to indicate loss of confidence.
Yeah.
We cannot have a situation where whatever takes place outside of the House is more valid than what takes place inside the House.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the principal objections that we a lot of people took in PERA, that how can you rely on extraneous evidence on the issue of confidence? Surely you must go back to the House upon which confidence resides.
Would His Majesty be tasked with choosing a new PM? You know, if the Prime Minister resigns, but there's a hung parliament, you know, which remains deeply fractured and divided, would His Majesty have to choose a new PM? And if so, how?
I think, you know, based on what we have learned in PERA, and I believe that this is the state of the law, though some of us might disagree with it, is that the moment there is evidence that the Prime Minister has lost confidence, even if the Prime Minister does not resign, he can be removed. I think that's what happened in PERA. That is also what happened in Sabah on the 10th of, the 10th of May, 10th or 11th of May, 2018. So the question of whether the Prime Minister resigns, that is of lesser importance now because of these two cases.
Yes,
but of
indeed.
Course, I think the right thing to do is, if the Prime Minister, he cannot honestly say that he still commands the confidence of the majority, then he should resign so that he will not put the His Majesty, the Yang Di-Pertuan Agong, in an awkward position.
Right.
Where he would have to tell the Prime Minister, look, it's time to step down.
Oh,
I think that is something that politicians and Prime Minister should not put the monarchy in such an awkward position. You know, it muddles the role of the monarchy. It unnecessarily brings them down into the mud of politics. And I think that is that isn't something right. And, you know, you hear about bait shots talking about the dignified and the efficient. The monarchy should always be in a dignified position. It shouldn't come down. It shouldn't descend to the level of politicians, with the greatest respect to all of them. And in such a situation, yes, once it's clear that the Prime Minister has lost confidence of majority, the YDPA would have to do what is normally done when choosing a new Prime Minister. He would select the person that is most likely to command the confidence of the majority. Normally, that is first offered to perhaps another one from the governing party to take over the role of the Prime Minister. If there isn't one or it's not clear, then he could invite the leader of the opposition to do so. So the situation then goes back to where it would be, as though as the Yang Di-Pertuan Agong is selecting a Prime Minister after a fresh election. But of course, in a situation where you have a fresh election, it's normally clear who would be able to command the confidence of the majority. But the selection process is, I would say, is the same. Perhaps Prof Shah could, you know, enlighten us more on that.
Let me just add, actually, your question was, Juliet, as to what's the role of the PM, the role of the Yang Di Pertuan in appointing a PM. The Constitution is very clear in Article 40, Clause 2, Subclause A, that the appointment of the Prime Minister is a discretionary power of the Yang Di Pertuan Agong. So the general impression of the public is that the appointment of a PM is a personal discretion of the King. I have to clarify that. If there is a clear-cut majority in the House after an election, or if the Prime Minister dies or resigns, and within the majority party there is a clear-cut leader, then the Yang Di Pertuan Agong really has no discretion. He doesn't want to get involved in a politics of appointing someone he likes or dislikes. Whoever has a majority, or whoever is the leader of the majority party, will have a right to be called to helm the office of the Prime Minister. However, Juliet, the situation is, if there is a hung parliament means nobody has a majority, or if there is a situation like today, where, Sin, you pointed out, we don't know whether there is a confidence or not, and yet actually the budget second reading is going through. So there is a lot of political instability and uncertainty. If there is a hung parliament, if there is instability, and there could be a lot of other permutations or variations. For example, the opposition may be deeply split. The Prime Minister's budget may fail. The Prime Minister may even lose the vote of no confidence, but the opposition cannot come together. In other words, we have a fractured parliament. then what does the King do?
Yeah.
I have to say this. His discretion becomes alive. And as Sinew pointed out, sadly, he gets drawn into the politics. You know, he may have to appoint what could be called a minority government. He may have to appoint someone who will hold the fort till elections are called. Australia has had that problems. Australia has had, Australian states have had this problem, that the ruling party cannot arrive at its leadership decision. They are fighting with each other about who will lead the party. And so what the Governor General does is, he takes a minority person, but a non-controversial person, and says, I will appoint you to hold the fort till things are settled. There have been cases where someone has been a prime minister of a state for something like 4 days or 5 days before things are finally worked out. So in answer to your question, if there is a clear-cut leader of a party with a clear-cut majority, then the King is obliged, as a constitutional monarch, to allow that person to form the government. But in a host of other situations, the King really acquires a central role, and his decision could alter the course of the nation's history. And what we are witnessing today, actually what we witnessed in February 2020, and what we are witnessing today, is a situation where actually the King is actually writing history. He is in many respects influencing the course of politics. His discretion in a hung parliament is very, very wide. Though not absolute, it's very, very wide. The only rule that I can say is quite firm is, he cannot rule the country on his own. He cannot become the CEO. He has to have a prime minister. But who? It could be actually a compromise candidate, a non-party or a minority party person, a compromise candidate who holds the fort, till things settle down a little bit.
Not to mention till the pandemic ends.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. Well, I'm afraid we're running out of time, gentlemen, but any last message that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I have a small message to say. All this that is happening in our country today, I think we need to amend our laws to ensure that this doesn't happen again. What happened in February 2020? We need to enact an anti-hopping law. But that's a very big issue. Yeah. Maybe, Juliet, you can have a separate session on that.
Definitely.
We need to amend the Constitution in Article 55, Clause 3, 55, Clause 4, and the 8th Schedule to forbid any election or by-election till the COVID-19 pandemic subsides. At the moment, the law is Parliament is for 5 years. And after 5 years, within 60 days, a new election must be called. But we are in such a terrible medical situation. Thirdly, we need to extend the rules about postal voting. Because of COVID, we need postal voting. We need to extend the rules about advance voting. We need to create rules about online voting. So postal voting, online voting, advance voting. I think we need to look at our election laws. I think we need to solve problems for the future. We don't want this to happen all over again.
Definitely. Now, Asinio, any last message you'd like to leave us with?
I think we live in very interesting times.
Understatement. Understatements in you.
it's very polite, interesting times.
And what we are seeing today is we are seeing a lot of that is in the Constitution. It hasn't been updated. It hasn't been reviewed, even though it should have been done. And the Constitution, like any other law, you know, after a period of time, you have to relook at it and you have to say, is this still working?
Yes.
Is there a way that we can improve it? It's not meant to be cast in stone and treated as, you know, that is the gospel truth. And like what Prof. Shutt had pointed out, there's just so many things that we need to change in the Constitution. And, you know, what happened in February, what is happening now or will happen in the future, we should probably relook at how in the Constitution we need to preempt certain situations.
Yes.
Where politicians, they do not act decently as how they should, because that is the Westminster tradition. And in such a situation, what is the constitution mechanism available to resolve such disputes? Because I think that pulling the His Majesty the King YDPA into a situation of awkwardness, into a situation where he has to be involved in the politics, that's something that we should avoid. Because His Majesty the King should be beyond that. He's above that. So that's my parting message. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you both of you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Emeritus Professor Dr. Dr. Shahd Salim Farooqi, Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Malaya, and Niu Sin Yu, a constitutional lawyer. And they were helping us break down Budget 2021 and, you know, what has happened and what is going to happen. So we will keep you guys updated, of course, and hopefully the gentleman will join us again, you know, come December. But if you miss any part of this interview or any previous Law and Behold interviews, you can always search for the podcast at our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify, and also on Google Podcasts and Apple Podcasts. This has been Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.